we are Sikomiyo. It means people of the ice. We've always had a close connection with the ocean. Summertime, and then when it freezes, still the same.
Reuben Flowers grew up along the frigid north coast of Labrador. Out on the ice with his father, he needed to rely on traditional ways of reading the land around him. His father taught him Inuit ways of tracking weather and ice conditions.
In the wintertime and or fall, when they're around, the northern lights are displayed across the sky in a big fancy fashion, and they're dancing all over the sky. He say, tomorrow it's going to be a windy day.
Reuben learned to analyze the many dances of the northern lights, the position of sun dogs,
a ring around the sun, ring around the moon,
and the direction of the wind.
If the wind backs in a counterclockwise fashion against the sun, the nice weather will probably be only lasting a day. But if the weather clears and the wind tracks and comes around clockwise, it's the same direction the sun travels across the sky, the fine weather period will be much longer.
These observations can mean the difference between life and death in the north. They let Reuben and his father know when it was safe to travel out on the ice for food or firewood, and to stay put when a blizzard was on its way. Now an elder himself, Reuben is passing this traditional knowledge on to a generation experiencing new challenges brought on by climate change. It's a warming planet faced by people of the ice. Hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. The disappearance of ice in the north is a clear sign of our changing climate, and it's a threat to Inuits who depend on ice for survival. As a young man, Reuben Flowers was fascinated by the weather, so he started writing journals, now three decades in the making, to document ice and weather patterns in Hope Dale Nunatsiavu.
I know when I was a child in the 70s and 80s, we could probably get easy 4 feet of sea ice in the harbor, but now it could be 3 feet, so it's thinning.
And Rex Howell is making sure communities that rely on the ice have the information they need to travel safely. He'll tell us about Smart Ice, an organization that combines traditional Inuit knowledge with new technology. It's part of a community response to an unusually mild winter.
Typically, the first week of February should be minus 20, minus 30 with the wind chill. But back in 2009, it was plus 5 degrees and we had a bunch of rain. And it happened again in 2010.
Plus, Robert Way takes us to the Torn Gat Mountains in northern Labrador, where he conducts much of his climate research. It's one of the places where climate change is most obvious.
There's old photos from the 1980s in some of these valleys where it's all tundra, and then you go back to some of these spots and you can see in some spots looking almost lush with shrubs and things like that in areas that would have been otherwise open tundra.
Today, as the north faces shrinking sea ice, how Inuit are responding and adapting to a climate crisis. The north coast of Labrador is home to a cold climate year-round. Unlike the interior of Labrador, summers here hit highs of about 10 degrees. In winter months, there's more snow here than in Arctic regions, and there's a lot of sea ice, usually. In recent years, the amount of sea ice is shrinking and is having major implications for Inuits on the north coast. The land provides what they need to survive here. Country foods like Arctic char, seal, and ptarmigan, and dry wood for heating. But without a solid layer of sea ice, they simply can't get to it. In order to make the most of these shorter ice seasons, it's crucial that travelers know how to read the land, to find a safe way to navigate it. Reuben Flowers is an Inuk life skills teacher from Hope Dale Nunatsiavut. He shows his students how to track weather, measure sea ice conditions, and all of the essential skills that it takes to survive in the north. For over three decades, Reuben has kept weather and ice journals. They prove that the climate is changing. Ruben, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you.
Describe to me these journals that you've been keeping for over 30 years. What kind of information are you recording?
I record all the weather, temperature, sky conditions, and the winds. And I take one recording just in the morning. Usually 98% of the time it's in the morning. And I've been doing that for 33 years come March. I also write in my journals some other things along with weather, like community happenings, quite major ones, and also like freeze-up time of the year and spring breakup time of the year, any major storms stand out. It's mostly weather and first sea ice crossing the harbor, first time out in boat in the springtime, things like that.
Oh, that's amazing. In terms of the ice, what specifically about the ice are you recording? Are you measuring it? Are you like just observing it? Or what observations are you making?
Yeah, we always observe the ice. And in recent years, especially, I measure the actually drill holes and measure the ice too. And I do that on my own. And I also do it with my students in the life skills program here. And we actually measured the ice today. Yeah, we actually go and do those things. And we observe, usually get to a high point, and we observe the offshore ice and how much open ocean is actually there. You can see it. And it also comes in really handy for hunting purposes.
That's fascinating. Why have you been tracking the ice and the weather? What's important about that for you?
I always had a great interest in the weather. I guess growing up, my parents being living the lifestyle that we do here, hunting, fishing, trapping, gathering, it always was in the family and the community here, the communities in Nunatsiavut. And I just had an extra interest, I guess, in learning about the weather. My father told me about different traditional ways to forecast the weather, because back then there were no real weather forecasting like we have today. I got really interested in that. And when I was 24, I decided to start doing a journal and recording things. And it just kept up. Now, 3 decades later, it's becoming even more interesting because of all the talk of climate change, global warming. The journals are more interesting now to look back on.
Yeah, no doubt. What have you learned over the past 3 decades about, you know, how things are changing?
I've definitely learned that it's cyclic. There are cycles. And they told me too, my parents told me back in the 1950s, before I was born, in the mid-50s, there was a period of very mild warming. Boats were out on New Year's Day, which was really, really rare, because usually it's frozen up solid here by early December. In the last decade or so, there have been a couple or 3 years here that resemble those mid-50 years. I know it's cyclic. It seems to me like even though it's still cyclic, the temperatures are edging a little bit more extreme, a little bit more on the warmer side. When it do get a bit warmer, it seems that little edge is a little warmer to me, possibly coinciding with global temperatures edging up there. Labrador also, we have these off years, but these off years are a little more off, I guess that's how to say it.
And what about in terms of the ice? What is happening with the ice in Nunatsiavut?
The ice is definitely thinning. It's not as when I was a child. It was much thicker then. We usually have 3 months, we say, December, January, and February here for our freezing months. Well, this year we lost December altogether. There was no freezing on the sea ice. The lakes were frozen. And we only started freezing here in middle of January. So we've only got February, really, because like when March comes in, you get freezing, but it's still like mostly at night, and a lot of days are getting warmer with the height of the sun. It's definitely going to be thinner ice overall by the time May rolls around, June breakup. Generally thinner overall, and generally less pack ice coming down from the north, from the Arctic. Because here on the Labrador coast, we have the Labrador Current pushing Arctic flows down the Labrador coast. And in the last number of years, we haven't seen as heavy pack ice flows. So it's, for the sea ice, it's generally thinning a bit. I know when I was a child in the 70s and 80s, we could probably get easy 4 feet of sea ice in the harbor, 4.5 feet sometimes. But now it could be 3 feet, a really good year, maybe 3.5 feet. So it's thinning. And also the outer islands here that are traditionally hunted in springtime and the later winter, some years you can't really get to them though. It's in open water. So it's changing that way out towards the Shina, the flow edge. It's, the ice is, thinner and less safe. Yeah. It's like receding a bit more.
And so what does that mean, for life in your area, you know, thinner ice, later freeze up, earlier melt, less sea ice? How is that affecting life in the Nunatsiavut?
It's affecting us physically and mentally. I think a lot of people sometimes get a bit concerned, and a lot of the hunters and people who gather the firewood because hope they'll, like, for example, where we are, we're right out, stuck out on a peninsula, and we really, especially, I think of all the five communities of Nunatsiavut, I think we probably depend on the sea ice most to get moving because the land is rough here. If you can picture Greenland or Baffin Island, it's similar here, not many trees at all. And we need that sea ice to travel in. Mm-hmm. Whereas some of the other Nunatsiavut communities are in more and they have better access to the land. So especially here, I think it's really affected us in later getting our firewood in, and sometimes to try to get hunting for certain animals, it can be later. It's too cold and freezing up for invoat, so you got a period there of inactivity really for getting out to the farther places, the more, so it affects us big time in that way.
And when did you realize that, you know, things were changing with the ice? Was it a gradual realization, or was it one day you woke up and saw the pattern and was like, oh?
It's gradual. Yeah, it's quite subtle, and you have to be careful always, of course, always have been forever on ice. But it seems these more recent years, in the last decade, you had to be even more vigilant. Some of the places that traditionally you've crossed could be too thin now, so you have to be extra careful, right? And from 2011 back to now, like, there were some really cold years. So, like, we kind of forgot about climate change, global warming type of thing for a while. And then we get last year and this year is similar. Last year was no snow, froze up a bit earlier. But this year, it just kept on going in December with rain and then mild temperatures. And it never froze up till, like I said, the middle of January. So, also, I didn't mention earlier, when the sea ice freezes, we can be more connected to our own communities here on the coast. In Nunatsiavut, we travel back and forth on snowmobile to communities. And that's another good way, you know, to keep in contact. And because airfare here is extremely high, like in a lot of northern Canada. So it just gives us another really good, much more economical option, right?
As well as, you know, connecting communities and allowing you to, you know, to go and hunt and gather your resources. How is the ice connected to your identity as Inuit?
There's a big connection there ever since I can remember. We are, I guess, Shikomiu. It means people of the ice. So we've always had a close connection with the ocean. Summertime, and then when it freezes, still the same. We hunt seals, and we gather fish, birds, seabirds. It's a big thing where the ocean is right next door, literally. It's always been a big thing for us here with snow and ice.
How have you noticed the changing ice and weather impacting animal patterns and, you know, their habits?
I do know there are some species that are coming farther north that we've never seen before. For example, the seabirds, the cormorant, popular in Newfoundland to the south of us. In the last 4 or 5 years or so, they've been coming up this way in the summer and trying to colonize on the islands where the eider ducks nest, and they destroy eider duck nests, eggs, seagulls, things like that. So that's an eye-opener. We've never, ever seen cormorants this far north.
And I imagine it affects seals as well and where they have their baby seals and so on.
That's true, definitely, because we depend quite a lot for our food on the ringed seal, Nutsik. And they are born here, unlike harp seals that are migratory. The ringed seal are born in this area. And if you don't have the correct sea ice and snow conditions on top of the ice, they can be really affected in their birthing rate, because they need the snow on the ice to form their dens, the ugglu, in the coming, like later winter, coming spring, that they have their young. And it's like a little house just underneath the snow on top of the ice. So when there's no snow on the ice, they suffer in their population that way, right? Other people have seen certain kinds of species of fish and sharks coming up this way in the summertime too, that probably never seen before, or see them more often than in the past.
Did you say sharks?
Yeah, there seems to be an increase in sharks up this way. We've always had sharks to a certain amount up here, but there seem to be more sightings and more possibly different species that usually are farther south.
Noted, not swimming on the Labrador coast anytime soon. So if the ice conditions are poor in the winter, if it's thinner and less, you know, shorter season, does that affect other seasons as well?
It does, because, for example, I know this year the boating season was longer, but when you get into really short days of November and December, boating is not ideal. It may not be froze up, but it's so cold that you get a lot of freezing spray and icing on the boats that you can't really go safely. And if you have less snowpack in the winter, come early summer, a lot of the land is getting really drier, and there are more inland, not out here, but inland of Labrador, there are more forest fires and things like that, right? And less, mm-hmm. less water, even locally, less water in our town reservoir, which is dependent upon precipitation. So the snowpack plays a big role. I know when the sea ice doesn't freeze here in late fall, early winter, we get more surf off the open ocean, for example, you know, like more the waves are beating the shoreline type of thing. It's a rugged shoreline and it's hard to break down here, but a lot of those late fall, early winter storms, the shoreline can be really rugged, you know, with ice pans and things afterwards, because the ice hasn't formed as it normally would during that time of the year, right? So I think the heavy sea ice dampens down the bigger waves type of thing.
Yeah. What do you think the risk is, you know, for future generations if, you know, the ice continues to disappear?
There's, I guess, some parts of our traditional life would be lost if the ice continues to disappear. I guess that would be the biggest impact, I guess, is the traditional ways. It definitely would not help that. I mean, we're losing enough now just through modern life, technology and things like that, you know. So I know we can't live the way we lived 100 years ago or even 50 years ago, but it's nice to know where we came from and our roots and our traditions, right?
And for you, as somebody who has been gathering this knowledge for three decades, and, you know, we're taught by your parents how to read the land as an Inuit person, why is it important for you to continue to pass it on?
I really like to pass it on, you know, to the children. And I have three adult children of my own, and it's really fulfilling to teach them about the things I was taught. There's something really good and satisfying, I guess, about teaching them things, ways to survive on the land, even though technology is all around us. There is no app for surviving a blizzard. There is no app to build an igloo. Things like that, it's good because they need to know how to do some of these things when the power goes out. It's a big part of our identity.
Well, Ruben, thank you so much for sharing some of your knowledge with me today.
As we say, nakumingay.
That is life skills teacher Ruben Flowers. Ruben is Inuk from Hope Dale Nunat, Siavu. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, we're on the northern coast of Labrador, where the ice stretches as far as the eye can see, and snowmobiles are the main mode of transportation.
Ice is important to us. In the winter, it's our way of travel, so it's really important to see what's happening to it. It's scary, I guess, the only way to explain it, because it is unpredictable, and every year it's getting later, freeze up, and the way it forms is different, and we think the water is warming up, so there's holes where there never used to be holes before in the ice.
That's Ron Webb, an elder who lives in Nain, Nunat Siavut. Ice is changing in the north. And while Inuit are finding some meaningful ways to adapt, northern climate researchers like Robert Way say more needs to be done to support community resilience. Robert tracks the acceleration of climate change in Nunat Siavut through glacial ice melt.
We've seen some pretty large increases. We've seen sort of a long-term warming over the last 70 years of more than 2 degrees. And, you know, it's really about, you know, a little bit more than two times whatever has happened across the globe. So, you know, if the globe is warmed, I don't know, 1.3 degrees, then we probably have something like 2.5, 2.6 in Nunat Siavut.
We'll hear more from Robert on the effects of climate change in Nunat Siavut a little later in the show. But first, we head to the northernmost community along the coast. Nain is located along the rugged coastline of the Labrador Sea in Nunat Siavut, a self-governing region of the Inuit of Labrador. The community is surrounded by striking fjords, towering mountains, and the vast icy waters that define this remote part of the world. Life in Nain is marked by a close relationship with the land and sea. Fishing, hunting, and gathering are important aspects of daily life, with locals relying on the sea ice to travel for food and materials. In recent years, that ice has become unpredictable.
The sea ice situation is practically brand new. It's totally different from what I'm used to doing. Before, we used to be able to kind of predict when ice going would be safe, which would be early September for the last 10 years anyway. But each year changes, and it's been hard on us.
That's the mayor of Nain, Joe Dicker. The changing sea ice is causing concern for his community, but it's also making way for innovation. That's where Smart Ice comes in. It's a not-for-profit organization that provides training and equipment to communities looking to combine the latest tech with traditional knowledge. Rex Howell is the manager of Nunat Siavut operations for Smart Ice. He is Inuk and lives in Nain. But when the ice is thick enough, he travels from community to community, some several hours away by snowmobile, to help monitor community routes that rely on sea ice. Rex, welcome to Unreserved.
Hello, Rosanna.
Now, we just heard some sounds out of Nain. How would you describe the community for our listeners who have maybe never been there?
Nain is the northernmost community in Labrador. There is no community north of Nain, so you can only fly to Nain year-round via Twin Otter, year-round, obviously. In the summer, we have a ferry/roll-on, roll-off ship that delivers goods in the summer. There are no roads, so we are your classic remote community where things only get in through planes, boats, or when the sea ice is safe, people travel on the sea ice to get to Nain from other communities.
Mm. And what do you do there in Nain?
So I work for Smart Ice as the manager. One of the main things that we do, that I do here in Nain with Smart Ice, is we operate the Smart Comedy in our own the community. And it's a device that we tow behind a snowmobile, and what it does, it measures the sea ice thickness. So one of the most important things that I do in my role here in Nain is to use the Smart Comedy on well-traveled routes that people use when they're traveling by snowmobile over the sea ice when the sea ice is there.
And so what did you call it? You use what to measure the thickness?
It's called a Smart Comedic. When you hear in the Comedic, it's the Inuit word for the wooden sled that we tow behind a snowmobile. It's a sensor that we basically lash onto our Comedic. So we just adopted the name and we call it locally the Smart Comedic.
Ah. And why is it important to know the thickness of the ice?
What we're finding is a lot of the traditional knowledge doesn't sometimes get passed on to one generation to the other. You know, back when I was a young boy or my father, when you went off with your family members to hunt for food, you know, you had to know the sea ice. So you were taught by your fathers, your grandfathers, when you were traveling on the land. And what we're finding now with the younger generations is they're not taking interest in going off with their family members. So they don't get taught the traditional knowledge of how to read the sea ice, where the dangerous sea ice areas are. The data that we provide with the Smart Comedy runs isn't meant for the people who know how to read the sea ice safely, who know how to interpret the ice conditions. It's meant for the people who aren't quite familiar with it. So it gives them an extra tool, extra information that they can look at on their phone to help people make more informed decisions before they travel on the sea ice.
And so once you've gathered the information as to how thick the ice is, you then put that on an app so people can download it on their phones and check it out?
Correctly, yeah. So the data goes through an app called Siku. They were founded in Santa Kilowak in Hudson Bay, they're in Nunavut. So we've partnered with them to put all of our data for free through their app that people can sign up, create an account, and it's easily accessible for everybody to get this data that Smart Ice provides for the people.
Right. In terms of Smart Ice, can you tell me a little bit more about that organization? Obviously, it measures the thickness of the ice, but what are the other things that it does in terms of the work on the ice?
Yes, Smart Ice, we're a not-for-profit enterprise. And that means any money that we do make just gets funneled back to the communities. So our main focus is on empowering local communities, local people in these communities, that we'll give them our two pieces of equipment that we have that we provide with them, one being the Smart Comedic. It's a mobile sensor that they tow behind the snowmobiles. And the second piece of equipment that we also give to the communities is called the Smart Buoy. And all that, if you can just imagine a 9-foot-long thermometer that we put in the sea ice. And on the outside, we have floats to help it float up in the water. But through going down through the center, the full 9 feet of it is 60 sensors. And the sensors are about 2.5 centimeters apart. So for the full length of it, we have these individual thermometers that we call thermistors that measure the temperature. So when the ice is safe enough, the operators will go out with this Smart Buoy. They'll drill 2 holes in the ice. They will lower it in so that it floats and reaches equilibrium. So the majority of it will be in the water and in the ice, but then you'll see maybe a foot and a half of it on top of the ice. Then we'll give it a couple days to freeze in. And then what it does using the thermistors, the little thermometers, we can tell how thick the ice is because the temperature on each little thermistor that are 2.5 centimeters apart, as it gets farther down, the temperature changes. We can tell how thick the ice is there. It just sits there in the ice and it takes temperatures twice a day, and then it'll get sent through a sat phone, and the data will be interpreted by somebody who will actually have to manually input how thick the ice is. So it's a really great indicator of how thick the ice is. And where we tend to put these smart boys are in the very well-traveled ice roads that where people travel, the community routes. Like Nain has two smart boys that we just put one out the other day. We will put one out tomorrow. And they're put on the well-traveled routes that many community members use. And it makes a lot of sense that they can just log on to their phone or their laptop where they have the app. Once they know the smart boy is deployed there, they can see for themselves really quickly how thick the ice is in that area.
Why was smart ice created?
We were actually founded because of the weather that we saw in 2009 and 2010 here in Maine. Many people from the Labrador Coast, if they are old enough to remember, they can recall that in 2009, it was the first week of February. So, typically the first week of February should be minus 20, minus 30 with the wind chill. But back in 2009, it was plus 5 degrees and we had a bunch of rain. And it happened again in 2010. People were unsure of their traditional knowledge because what we were seeing in those 2 years was stuff that we've never saw before. The people with the traditional knowledge couldn't really rely on it because they were seeing things that they couldn't see before. So a lot of people were concerned that their traditional ways wasn't able to reliably help them anymore with what they were taught on how to read ice conditions. So a lot of people were concerned, and the Nunavut Tsleil-Waututh government actually got a feel of it from the community members. So they reached out to Memorial University in St. John's where they found Dr. Trevor Bell. And he was a glaciologist in St. John's who worked in Northern Labrador. And he was the person with the ice experience that they reached out to him. And it was him and a few other people that really helped form Smart Ice back after 2009, so 2010, where we had the rain 2 years in a row consecutively. And Smart Ice has now just blossomed. We're growing at a rate that is great for us as a company for growth. But I mean, conversely, people are seeing the effects of climate change and they're seeing the need for technology such as Smart Ice, which is bad in the whole sense that, everybody's seeing climate change. But at the core of it, we're doing what Inuit or Indigenous people has really done with anything that we've seen in life, is just adapt to it and learn to live with it and adapt and to live with the situation that we're in.
How does a typical day for you look out on the ice? Or is there a typical day?
Yes. So we've just recently, one of the pieces of equipment that I already told you about was a Smart Cummins. So Thursday, we went for a Smart Cummins run south of Nain. We actually did two Smart Cummins runs last week. One is a test run, and one, we traveled about 2 hours south of Nain measuring the sea ice thickness. But because of weather, we actually had to turn around and we didn't complete the run. Hmm. I do many things, Rosanna, but I mean, one of the main things that I get to do is I get to travel on the sea ice. And I deploy the equipment. I maintain the equipment. I train locals to come along with me and I teach them as well. And, at some point I'll be traveling. So I need reliable people that I can teach them and they can do the stuff here in my absence. But nothing really beats my position is when I'm out on the sea ice itself. For Indigenous people, for people in general, nothing beats getting away from the hubbub of all the Zoom meetings and the time constraints and budgets. So at the heart of it, I'm an operator out on the ice, enjoying the weather, enjoying the sun, but I'm also doing something for my community. We're seeing shorter ice seasons. Wherever I travel to, I talk to the people I'm training. I talk to the elders. We'll have elders meetings. And everywhere I go, Rosanna, everybody's seeing a shorter ice season because of climate change.
How are northern communities learning to adapt, if at all, to these huge changes in the climate?
That's a great question. So certainly technology like Smart Ice is going to be needed. I've been to many communities, and the common thing that I can say that they're adapting to it is they're realizing climate change is happening in their community. The elders are realizing climate change is happening, and they realize that the young people may not have the traditional knowledge or the know-how of how to adapt to it. So they're also trying to get their traditional knowledge out to the young people. you know, whatever programs they may have with actually going out with the elders, or, you know, meeting with the elders and the elders, you know, imparting some traditional knowledge to these young people, be it meetings with the young people, or, you know, coming out with posters with things that you should do before you travel on the CUS, what you should check, and some traditional knowledge booklets or tips and tricks, whatever you want to have, of traditional knowledge that the other people may not know, but the elders want to keep their people in the community just safe, so that's the best thing that you can hope for.
Where do you find hope in this work, Rex?
I find hope when I go to a community where I've never been before. I talk to the people I'm training, and they say, yes, Rex, we're seeing climate change. And then, you know, I'll teach them on how to use equipment, how to safely travel to sea ice, train them in first aid. And then at the end of the training, I'll sit down and talk to them. I said, do you really see the need for technology as smart ice? And they'll say, yes. The trainees that I taught say, the data that we are collecting is great. The operator in that community, when they do a smart comedic run, they can then post it on their community's Facebook page, or they go on the radio, so they can inform the community members of what they saw in the CS. And once these operators know something that they're doing really can impact and help keep people safe in their communities, it makes it all worth it. And it, even more so, in some of these training sessions at the end of the week, when we're done, we'll have a public meeting where we'll invite everybody to come in. When elders tell me, when they say to me, Rex, thank you for coming, and thank you for teaching the people in my community on how to do this so that they're keeping people in their community safe, it makes it worth it. Like, you know, I could be gone for 20 days and I could be, you know, tired. I need to get home. But for me to sit down in that meeting and an elder to tell me, good job, what you're doing is valuable, it's needed. For me to see the value of an elder seeing it in the value of what we're doing in their community, again, it just makes it all worth it.
Rex, thank you so much for your time today and your wisdom.
Thank you.
That's Rex Howell, the manager of Nunatsiavut operations for Smart Ice. Rex is from Nain. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild.
My name is Tiga Michelin, and we are in Nain, Labrador. I wish it was colder because I want to go off too. Well, we could go up the ponds and stuff, but that's like the only place we could go. Like, some people would go down Two Mile Bay or something to like fish. But that's not going to happen this year, I don't think, because the ice is like barely ice.
Global warming is accelerated in the north, and sea ice is not the only ice that is being depleted by the rising temperatures. In the Torngat Mountains, north of Nain, there are over 40 small glaciers, but they cling to their very existence in the face of a warming climate. These remnants of the last ice age are the only glaciers left in eastern continental North America. There are no settlements on the mountain range, but Inuit have a strong spiritual connection to the Torngat Mountains. It's the place where spirits dwell. These mountains are a part of Robert Way's research. Robert is an associate professor and Canada Research Chair in Northern Environmental Change at Queen's University, where he leads the Northern Environmental Geoscience Laboratory. Being Nunatsiavut Miit gives him a unique perspective on the issues he studies. Robert, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
So tell me, what are the Torngat Mountains?
It's the southernmost limit of the Arctic in Canada. And so this is really about as far south as you can get true Arctic environments. It's above tree line. And it also is where you have the southernmost kind of small mountain glaciers in the eastern part of Canada as well. And so it's a really interesting spot from a lot of perspectives. You know, you have things going on in the tundra there and changes that are occurring, but also high up in the mountains. You have glaciers and you know, some of the ongoing challenges that glaciers have faced. So,
yeah. And speaking of understanding those changes, how do the Torngat Mountains help us understand climate change?
One of the things that's been pretty obvious there is that some of the tundra is really changing quite a lot. and we could see that really obviously. You know, there's old photos from the 1980s in some of these valleys where you can picture this, you know, deep kind of U-shaped valley, and it's all tundra. And then you go back to some of these spots and you can see that there's all kinds of dwarf birch and other forms of shrubs growing up in all these places. Things that used to be open are now becoming really green, and some spots looking almost lush with shrubs and things like that in areas that would have been otherwise open tundra. And, you know, one of the tie-ins to the type of work that we do on glaciers, and that's, you know, more of my focus area versus some of the plant work, is we've started to try and understand what these glaciers mean for the downstream environments and in terms of contributing water, and, you know, does that have implications for the species that use these valleys? And, you know, even something as complex as, you know, does it impact the water temperatures that eventually reach the ocean? And that it's all kind of a connected system.
Yeah. What do we know about the, you know, this increase in temperatures in the north?
It kind of varies over time, but in Inatsiavut, we've seen some pretty large increases. We've seen sort of a long-term warming over the last 70 years of more than 2 degrees. And the fall and the early winter, it really is a time period where we've seen a fair bit of warming. And, you know, the implication of that is, you know, that's obviously when the snow falls. That's obviously when the ice forms. It's a really important period for the winter time. And so seeing changes in that time period can mean a lot for systems, and systems we're still trying hard to understand. And, you know, you hear discussion about it, especially in communities where, you know, not having ice forming in the time period that people are used to in the fall has a lot of implications for people in terms of access to the land. And that's something that, you know, more and more people are thinking about, especially.
Yeah. Can we just drive that point home a little bit more? I mean, many people in the South really don't care. They're like, so it's warmer. Great. Why is this a big deal for you in the North?
You know, one of the myths that I have come across actually quite a bit when talking about this is you get people who will hear, okay, so you get less ice, so maybe you travel less on snowmobile between communities, but, you know, then you got water and you can just use other things. But it doesn't quite work that way. And most people who spend any bit of time out on the land knows that you have much greater restrictions on when you can travel by speedboat between communities than you do on snowmobile and by ice. You know, a wind speed of 40 kilometers an hour out in boat can be incredibly dangerous, whereas wind speeds of 40 kilometers an hour on snowmobile is fine, right? And so, like, it doesn't just transfer equally that if you take away the ice, you get a reduction in the amount of access. It's not just suddenly you get more travel via boat. And then there's the other piece, and I think this is something that people in the north obviously know, but people in southern Canada don't always know, is that throughout Inuit Nunavut, there's only a couple of communities that have any seasonal road access. Every other community is fly-in or has access to some seasonal ferry services in some cases. And that means that people in those places are very reliant on the weather conditions, the ice conditions. You know, having ice there means freedom to be able to get out and travel between communities. Having water there means greater restrictions in terms of in boat, and also probably more reliant on small twin otter aircraft or whatever to connect between communities. The other thing is, I mean, the high cost in the north of air travel is prohibitively expensive. Just as an example, like, I'm in Goose Bay in central Labrador now. We have road access here, which is very good, and we do have an airport. So you fly into Goose Bay, and from somewhere like Ottawa, it's a couple hours flight, and it's, you know, $1,000 or $1,200 to get here. And then from Goose Bay to go to Nain in Inatsiavut, then you're talking about another $1,000. And then you picture what it's like even flying to even more remote areas in northern Canada, although Nain's quite remote. And you could just see how the cost kind of picks up. So, or think about, you know, having a family of four. and ending up having to spend $10,000 to travel. In a lot of these communities, you know, connecting between the communities, the cost is really expensive. Whereas, you know, if you are able to drive on snowmobile between the communities, it just costs you whatever you need for a tank of gas, right? So it's quite a different experience in that regard. And I think it's something that's not only important from the perspective of costs, but also just culturally and spending time together. So,
yeah. And that's just like a human cost, right? That's not even the effect on animals and landscape and so on.
Yeah. You know, we do a lot of permafrost work, and some of the, especially in some of the coastal areas, we've seen a lot of change. Some of these landscapes have, like, you know, a lot of mounds of permafrost have just collapsed, and areas that probably had been stable for hundreds of years are, you know, now turning into pools of water in some of these spots. Not everywhere now, mind you. I don't want to make it seem like it's something that's going on all over the place, but there are spots where that type of thing is occurring. And then from the wildlife perspective, I mean, in Labrador, we had the collapse of the George River caribou herd, where the herd went from a million animals or so down to under 10,000. And part of that is sort of long-term fluctuations. Part of that is overhunting. And then part of it is probably some degree of there's a climate piece in there too. When you have less ice cover, you have, you know, to go longer routes to go around lakes and things like that. Depending on how the snow is, that can impact the body condition of caribou. So there's lots of factors to think about. And one that they talk about in other parts of the north quite a bit is when you get these big midwinter melt events, it can make it really hard for the caribou to dig through the snow to reach the stuff they like to eat too, right? So there's a lot of factors that come into play, and it's, you know, it's always thinking about things as a connected system.
Yeah. And as a researcher who's watching this, where is your biggest focus?
One of the big projects we have that we're working on is we're trying to generate some maps for the community of Nain to help them with figuring out the spots that are more risky to build on in the future with changes to permafrost. And that's something that's sort of been a long time coming. And so we're really starting to dive deep into that program, especially this summer upcoming, because, you know, when you have a growing community that has all kinds of needs for additional housing and additional infrastructure, you know, you don't want to be having to spend extra cost, extra time, especially with short building seasons, dealing with issues associated with like hazards and stuff. So that's part of the work that, you know, we're focusing on. And then we have the glacier work we started up again recently, and we started to do a youth program with it. So the last two summers, we took up three Inuit youth with us into the park. And, you know, there's a piece that's more around plants, and then there's a piece that's more around kind of rivers and streams. And then there's a glacier piece, you know, where we try and get these youth up onto the glacier to spend a bit of time there and see the type of work done and be involved in some of that work. And that's something we're hoping to continue in the coming years and for as long as we can keep it going, because, you know, I think it's something that is a unique experience that people get to, you know, and plus they get to say they've been on a glacier, you know, and it's not something that people in this region get a lot of chances to do. And just to say the research piece, so the idea with that is there really hasn't been much knowledge about how much change is going on with these glaciers and whether they are changing a lot or not. And so we're hoping to be able to use this program to help understand how a few of these glaciers are changing each year to see if what that means for the future. And we really don't know a lot.
Is there something in particular about Labrador, you know, where it's situated, the landscape, that makes it more able to watch these climate changes?
Yeah, actually, you know, Labrador is not as far north as kind of the territories, but yet it's got climate conditions that are more similar to them, just as a result of that cold Arctic water coming down. But also, you know, this is an area where the sea ice really expands out to cover around, right? And so we know with future climate change that snow and ice is probably going to be one of the first and most obvious changes that we expect to see. And you know, Labrador has a lot of snow and ice, but also just, you know, it's hard to separate out the piece where people are so connected to the snow and ice here, and it's it really impacts them when they see those changes. So it's part of the impetus between trying to understand what goes on there as well.
Yeah. And what do you think, you know, we should be doing with this information as a global community?
The simplest message I would say is that until emissions of carbon dioxide reach zero, warming isn't going to stop and it's going to keep going. And so if we continue on the path we're on, we're just going to keep seeing additional warming. Now, we know that this is going to be a bit of a battle to get things towards that net zero piece. And so one of the things that we have to think about in the meantime is about climate adaptation and some of the ways in which that we can put in place opportunities for resiliency and help build resilient communities, especially in the north. And I think that that's, you know, I don't want to say that the focus has to go there, because I still think the focus has to be on reducing emissions. But, you know, recognizing the types of changes that we're seeing in the Arctic, it sort of feels like we're far behind in terms of investing in making communities more resilient. And one of the things that I also think a little bit about is, like, you know, you have communities that they don't only have to adapt to climate change, but also to a history and a legacy of underinvestment and a lack of infrastructure in place to be able to support these communities. Just historically, you know, when you're doing this type of work and you know, you're trying to understand climate change, this is all happening in the backdrop of having other issues that are kind of at the forefront as well. You know, when we go to land in Tinian to do some of our work, you know, we land on probably one of the worst airstrips in Canada and one of the ones that's most in need of replacement and most at risk of climate change doing damage to it. And now there's, you know, plans for a new airstrip, but it took a lot of lobbying and many, many years and many cries on deaf ears before finally that was starting to be dealt with. So I would just say that, you know, addressing some of the systematic infrastructure gaps in the north, it should be a key part of climate adaptation and thinking about how to respond to climate change, giving, you know, people the tools and the opportunities to be able to be put in place to succeed, I guess.
Robert, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated.
Robert Way is an associate professor at Queen's University. He's from Happy Valley, Goose Bay in Labrador. You can learn more about his research and the acts of resilience and adaptation Reuben Flowers and Rex Howell are engaged in. Just go to our website at cbc.ca and follow us on Facebook. That's where you'll see a photo of Rex and his crew out on the ice, dragging along their smart Cometics behind their snowmobiles. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Kasher, Amanda Geer, Rhiannon Johnson, and Elena Hudgens-Lyle. Shout out to our colleagues at CBC Newfoundland and Labrador for sharing some of the perspectives they recently gathered in Nain. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Ginanaskamit Nawo. I will say.